program, my special guest is Adam Hayden. Adam is a graduate-trained philosopher, and he documents his battle with advanced brain cancer. He'll be sharing his story with us today. And I'll play an encore presentation of the very first interview I did at WICR with the great John Robbins. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversations begin now. I heard through a friend about Adam Hayden's story and that he lived in Greenwood, right here in the Indianapolis area, and that he was using the rest of his days, really, to promote education on death awareness, on brain tumors. He'll be doing a fundraiser for the National Brain Tumor Society. We'll have information on that later on in the program. That'll be April 22nd in Greenwood. Adam is a graduate-trained philosopher, freelance writer and blogger, speaker, lecturer, and it's a delight to have him in the studio with us today. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's always a joy for me to have guests actually in the studio. So many of my interviews are phone calls because a lot of the people don't live anywhere close to Indianapolis. But you're from Greenwood.
I am, yeah.
And you have three young boys.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And what are their ages?
So they are 6, 4, and 2 years old.
Oh, wow.
So just spaced right in a row.
Yeah. And you have a lovely wife. How long have you guys been married?
Yeah, Whitney and I have been together for... we've been married coming up on 8 years.
Okay.
In June.
Yeah.
But we've known each other for much longer.
Well, there's several things about you. The second one is why you're here. But the first one is, for several years, you had a master's in philosophy and you were a bartender.
Correct.
Although most people would say bartenders and hairdressers are philosophers or counselors.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And I know a lot of people knew you in that role
mm-hmm.
because you were very good at it. But the story you're here today is that you're living with an advanced brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And let's start where this began and looking at your blog, and we'll talk more about your blog too. I really love what you're doing with that. A lot of it really started in 2015 when you started coming down with various symptoms. So let's start there. Talk about some of the symptoms that you had.
Sure.
Only because I never know who's listening across the country. We also podcast this on Blog Talk Radio. I don't know, maybe someone's having some symptoms, you know, and they don't know what to do about that. But let's just start there and share how all this unfolded for you.
Sure.
Because you're only in your early 30s, too.
That's right. Yeah, I'll be 36 the month that we are recording this interview. So,
wow, okay.
In April.
Okay.
So our, you know, many of us have holiday traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And our Christmas time has been kind of the same routine or tradition since Whitney and I have been married, and that's to celebrate Christmas Eve with family and friends and snacks. And my mom makes a great queso. And we have chips and cheese.
Props to your mom because she's sitting in the studio with us.
My mom is here, which is terrific.
Yeah.
And I also, I then want to think about how I censor my remarks as well.
Thank you.
Yes.
I've encouraged my engineer to do the very same thing.
Good.
So we're all good here.
All right.
All right.
I will be compliant with certain FCC standards, et cetera. So Christmas Eve, we gather around with friends and family. We usually spend the night of Christmas Eve at our home, Whitney and I, and of course now with kids, it becomes even more fun. We get up Christmas morning and the kids open the presents. We head to my folks' house for brunch. Whitney's parents, they also live nearby in Mooresville, Indiana, which is not too far of a drive from where we live. So we have brunch with my parents. We head to her folks' house for dinner, spend the evening of the 25th at their home, and then come back to our place on the 26th. Mm. So it was December the 26th of 2014, just the end of that year on the cusp of 2015. And we were returning home from fun and presents and everything that mm-hmm. the holidays are about or tend to be about. And we, you know, we lived on a second floor condominium. I was pulling all the presents upstairs and we were getting, you know, things put away in the laundry and so on and so forth. I took a few steps in our condo towards our bedroom to actually use the restroom. And I started to feel dizzy. And it wasn't as though the room was spinning, but I just had a feeling about me of dizziness. That was quickly followed by some weakness through my left leg especially. And I needed to go down to the floor. And I didn't pass out. I didn't lose consciousness. But I just sort of crumbled to the ground. And I quickly began reporting symptoms to Whitney. And I, at that point, I still had my wits about me enough to realize something was the matter. Mm-hmm. And I thought, the ambulance will be called soon, and I'm not sure if I will be aware or conscious for that event. So I wanted to sort of, I guess, download everything I was experiencing. So I told Whitney, I'm feeling dizzy. The room isn't spinning. I don't have strength through my left leg. She said, can you make it to the bedroom? I was just a few steps away from our master bedroom. And she said, do you think you can make it there? And I sort of pulled myself along just the extra few feet. We don't live in a mansion, so it wasn't as though I had to travel to the west wing of the home. It was just a few feet away. And after 6, 7, 8 minutes, the symptoms began to subside, and strength sort of returned to my limbs, and the dizziness subsided, and I was able to stand up on my own. And I came out of the bedroom and just said, well, that was a strange episode. And that's the very first of those episodes.
And how often did they come back once that started?
Yeah, so it wasn't until March of 2015, so about 3 months or so later. And I was in grad school at that time, and I was enrolled in grad school at IUPUI, which is a local university. Mm-hmm. And I was outside in a courtyard area speaking with a friend after one of our classes, and I began to feel that same dizziness again. And I recalled, well, the next thing that will happen is that I'll need to sit down somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I found a way to exit that conversation quickly, and I just began scanning where can I find a bench, and made my way to one, sat down in another 5 or 6 minute episode. So it had now been two in about a 3 month period. And it was at that time in March of 2015 that really the intensity, the frequency, the duration began to increase from that point forward.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to June 10th, 2016. The pathology arrived, and you got some news from the doctor.
Yeah. So I had been reporting these symptoms to my primary care physician, and I had been seeing certain specialists. They became intense to the point that my doctor said, we really need to get you an MRI. Mm-hmm. So we had that MRI. In fact, that was on Friday, the 13th of May. That MRI indicated a large mass. At that point, we didn't know if it was a primary brain tumor, meaning that a primary tumor originates in the brain, a secondary tumor would be a metastatic cancer that would spread from elsewhere in the body. So by imaging alone, it's very difficult to diagnose these things. So I had a surgery, and it takes some time for an official pathology report to arrive. On June the 10th, we received the pathology results, and I was diagnosed with a glioblastoma, which is a grade 4 astrocytoma for the clinicians listening in, but it is an advanced stage and a currently incurable form of brain cancer.
So what was that like when you first got that news, when Whitney got the news? If you can take us back to that moment.
So I think there were two things that stand out in my mind. So like many lay people in medicine, at any rate, the way that the lay folks understand medicine, it is a lot of jargon. And so something like glioblastoma, I didn't have any reason to be familiar with that term. So the diagnosis itself did not make much sense to me. The two things that did make sense to me, one is that my oncologist's nurse reached across from her seat, and in each one of her hands held my hand and my wife's hand and just squeezed our hands as the doctor spoke to us. And typically, folks are not reaching out and holding your hand unless something very serious is happening. Mm-hmm. So that was my first, okay, this is a big deal. And then the second thing is my oncologist said, it is extremely unlikely that you will not have a recurrence of this tumor, of this cancer. So there's a little bit of a double negative construction there. Mm-hmm. This is one of the difficult things about glioblastoma is the recurrence rate is very high. So even if you zap it with radiation and surgically remove it, the way that the cancer grows and spreads in the brain makes recurrence a near certainty.
Mm. And how long did it take for you to process that? Here you are with three kids, beautiful wife, your life's ahead of you. You're doing great. You probably had all these other dreams like a lot of people do. And then, boom, that happened.
Yeah, it came at such an interesting time because it had been, we talked about 2015, the onset of these symptoms. And in fact, in retrospect, they were diagnosed as seizures, which mm-hmm. we didn't know at the time. Mm-hmm. So it had been a slow build from 2015 until, as you remarked, June 10th of 2016. So it was over a year of dealing with these symptoms. And then things began to move very, very quickly. So gradually and then suddenly. And hearing that news on June the 10th, I had just completed surgery. I was actually admitted inpatient at an acute rehab facility. So I had been learning how to walk again after brain surgery. I was in a wheelchair after surgery. So it came amidst so many immediate obstacles mm-hmm. that I think it took really some time to really wrap my head and for Whitney to wrap our heads around the diagnosis. We were worried about my immobility and that I wasn't yet ambulatory. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. So I think it took us a while because mm-hmm. we are in such a foreign place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think I shared with you before, I've served 13 years full-time as a hospice chaplain. I'm currently hospice chaplain, but part-time for the last 2 years. And I went back to it because I loved serving people who are facing their own mortality. And like you, and we'll talk about this too, I'm passionate about demystifying death in this country. So I do a lot of teaching on the art of living and dying and making death our constant companion that I've learned from my Buddhist friends and all this and that. And so I'm around a lot of families also who've had to go through some hard things. And of course, as a father, I'm thinking, how have you shared this news with your children?
Either only one or at least one flash of parenting brilliance that I had. So when the kids came to visit me for the first time in the hospital, and our youngest was only 8 months at this time, so what he recalls is likely zero. But when the kids came first to visit us, my oldest, he is perceptive and smart and observant. And of course, you wouldn't need to be those things to see the 30-some surgical staples that were in my head. Mm-hmm. So that needed to be addressed with Isaac, our oldest. And mm-hmm. What I told him was, we walked through what happens when you fall down and skin your knee. So, well, we clean it up and we bandage it, and eventually we can remove the bandage. And I said the same thing will happen to Daddy's head. And in fact, the next time he came to visit me at the hospital, the first thing he did was he showed me his knee. Mm-hmm. And that was an indication to me that he understood. Now, that set the tone, and I didn't realize it at the time, but that set the tone that I think is actually really important when parenting through circumstances like this, is that Whitney and I have said, if the kids are able to see something, mm-hmm. Then it needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. The kids at this point, they don't see the cancer. So the way that we talk about that is much more abstract. So the kids do know that Daddy has an injury on his brain. Mm-hmm. We have not yet used the word cancer. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not because we're afraid of it, mm-hmm. but I think it's because cancer carries so much cultural significance that to equip our kids with that language, and if especially our oldest takes that to the school bus or to the playground or into his classroom,
yeah.
I don't know what others would report about the experiences of their family members with cancer and if that would or would not align with our experiences.
Yeah. So here's why I think you're my new hero. Here you are at this stage in your life, blessed with such a beautiful family, an amazing mom, by the way. Okay. And you get this news, but a lot of people, and people would understand that, would just go in depression and complain until it's their last day. Why me? Why me? Why me? And I'm not saying you probably didn't have those moments. It would be natural to have those moments. But what has impressed me about you, Adam, is you decided to make a difference with all of this. You're out lecturing. You've got an amazing blog. You're a gifted writer, by the way. A lot of research. You're talking to I don't know how many people, all kinds of interviews. What was it inside you that decided to say, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to get the word out and, and be a voice.
Yeah, the moment of illumination, I think, for me was so that inpatient acute rehab facility where I was undergoing intensive occupational and physical therapy, that was in a brain trauma unit. The brain trauma unit is a locked unit. So you have folks that, because of all sorts of cognitive impairment, may not make wise decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. I was in a wheelchair with a wheelchair alarm in bed. There was a bed alarm. It was in an environment where I felt very much under watch at all times. So that was psychologically taxing. But what I realized is that there are many people that are in that setting who are not able to speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I was able to. So the way that, we have these functional areas of the brain, and depending on where your trauma or surgery or cancer, depending on where that is located in the brain, you will have different impairments and side effects and so on. So my higher level cognitive functioning so far has been left more or less intact. Mm-hmm. So I said, here's a population of folks that are not able to speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. Here I am, someone who is able to speak for himself. Mm-hmm. So I felt almost a sense of duty and responsibility to raise my voice on behalf of folks who are not able to.
Yeah. You have a passion for educating. I'll use that word. Maybe you have a better word. The professional healthcare community. You've spoken to a lot of docs, a lot of nurses and such. What are you telling them? What's your message?
Yeah. So the importance of human touch is something mm-hmm. that I want to really, I think as we grow in technology and with instruments and diagnostic protocols, as we introduce more of those innovations, we're also removing the human contact more and more. I had a great professor at IUPUI who runs their medical humanities program who talked about the advent of the stethoscope, that you have more accurate readings, a more consistent data collection, but rather than placing your hands on a patient, you're now one step removed with this technology. It's difficult to think of the stethoscope as technology, but certainly it was. So I think that's one of my key messages, is that, in fact, during a surgery, and I don't know if we'll talk much about surgery or not, but during surgery, there was a nurse in the operating room whose job it was to hold my hand mm-hmm. and to sort of guide me through that process. Mm-hmm. And that for me, the patient undergoing the procedure, that I think the nurse holding my hand maybe had a more important role than the neurosurgeon operating on my brain.
Mm.
I wouldn't say that to him. I hope he's not listening.
I don't have it with me now, but I'm thinking of an article. I get this email from the Daily Good, it's called. And there was one about a week ago, and I shared it with the hospice team. It was a doctor who wrote a letter to all the healthcare providers when his own mom ended up in serious condition in the hospital, and what it was about. And every paragraph, every sentence started with, because of your sacred touch, because of your sacred touch. And then, what he was trying to say is exactly what you just said. We've gotten so far away from human touch, from love, from compassion, from just holding a hand. Yeah. And when he witnessed these caregivers who aren't high on the pecking order in a hospital, he called them the new heroes. And it was just such a beautifully written letter, but that's exactly what you were talking about, that I personally think that's what we need more than ever now in healthcare and in the assisted livings I'm in. There seems to be such a lack of, the word I'm going to use is something Schweitzer came up with back in 1915. That's reverence for life. In German, it was the awe and wonder or the mystery of life. But it's revering one another and knowing that there is your brother or your sister.
Yeah.
It's the whole golden rule, or you could call it karma. What you put out comes back to you. But that's what you're passionate about, and everything that I've read that you're teaching on, that's the core for a lot of that as well.
I think that's right. You know, my wife is I mean, she's just, but she's my biggest advocate and absolute champion. She is an occupational therapist and has been. She's worked in this space for 10 years, over 10 years, and she's worked at Wishard and at Eskenazi, and she's very passionate about serving a population that traditionally has been underserved.
Right.
Every opportunity I get to lift up the work that Eskenazi does, it's wonderful work, and the facility is beautiful. If you do live in Indianapolis, you can visit there and have lunch, and it's a great campus. But you know, that's what I've learned through my relationship with my wife, long before this diagnosis, is that the care that she provides, helping people get out of bed, helping people learn to shower, activities of daily living, that is hands-on. That you're not doing that from behind a curtain, but in fact, you are interacting in a real personal, deep way with the folks that you care for. And my wife has taught me how important that is, even before I was a beneficiary of that treatment.
Yeah. And what you're saying, whoever is listening, no matter what they do, or if they're retired or what have you, these are principles that we can implement into our daily lives, the way we handle and react to our grandchildren, our children, our parents, our elderly parents, our grandparents. It's just with that compassion and love that you're talking about that you witnessed your wife being able to do as well.
Yeah.
Before I forget, I want to bring this up. On April 22nd, I believe, is there a fundraiser down in Greenwood?
That's exactly right. So I've been I say long time. I guess this has been, I'm coming up on 2 years with a diagnosis, so it's how you measure time, which is relative. So for a long time, I've been a volunteer advocate with National Brain Tumor Society. It's an organization that funds a whole lot of research in the brain tumor space. In fact, they're the largest nonprofit in the U.S. Funding brain tumor research. And I've really enjoyed my work with National Brain Tumor Society. And we've reached a point where I want to give back to National Brain Tumor Society. You mentioned that I was a bartender while in grad school and then holding a master's in philosophy. So the service industry has in fact rallied around me and my family during this time. So there is a restaurant, Reverie, in Greenwood that most folks probably know about if you're local. It's a great restaurant. I had a wonderful time working for chef owner Mark Henricks there. I, in fact, opened a speakeasy type bar that's connected to the restaurant. And so I had a great time there, and I thought, you know, we're going to host a fundraiser, but we're not going to do a walk run because I am not a walk runner.
You could watch a walk run.
I could cheer people on and,
yes,
you know, talk to them about philosophy. but I said, we're going to do a fundraiser in a way that makes sense. And so we're going to just throw a party. The Cubs are playing that afternoon, so we'll probably have the Cubs on the radio. Having a friend who does live music. Local television anchor Lauren Casey is going to be there to MC the event. There'll be a nice opportunity for folks that attend to enjoy some local breweries. Mashcraft and Central State will be there. We're proud of our kind of partner gold sponsor. Is the Blake Strong Bowel Fund, named after a Blake Bowel who passed away from gliosarcoma. I'll tell you that Blake's journey started just a little bit before my journey. Gliosarcoma and my diagnosis of glioblastoma, you know by the similarities of names that there are similar cancers. And it's a great way that the Blake Strong Fund carries on Blake's legacy, and that we feel honored that Blake Strong will support our event by being there in person and being a gold sponsor. So music, beer, philosophy chats, whatever.
No, it sounds like a wonderful time, and we'll certainly do what we can to promote that event also as well. I got to ask, though, because I found that when needs are known, the community here in Indianapolis is pretty darn generous. Are there needs that you and your family have?
I think
And if there are, how can they help?
That's a generous, very charitable question to ask. I'll say that, our family has just been really enveloped in support from our community, from friends and family, from communities of faith, from colleagues. You know, this is always, I'm sure it's, why didn't you say this and this and this? In retrospect. Listen, I think that the message that I try to share is that, you know, we need to find causes that we care about, that mm-hmm. are important to us, mm-hmm. and to invest and give ourselves to those causes. So I think mm-hmm. that the greatest gift that is a continuation of honoring me and whatever legacy I'm making in my family mm-hmm. is to find the cause that you're most passionate about and to invest your emotions, passion, time in that cause. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the greatest way to recognize what I'm doing here.
Okay, so you kind of answered my question without answering my question. So there's no needs, is what I'm hearing right now.
Right.
I'm taken care of. Okay, good. Just wanted to make sure, because I so appreciate what you're about and what you're doing with your message out there. And by the way, speaking of messages, you wrote some time ago a post called The Benefit of Death Talk. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So I do think that American culture, that death tends to be taboo. I have a tremendous amount of respect for our medical professionals who go through decades of training to be equipped with the skills and experience mm-hmm. to provide us excellent care. Mm-hmm. And so this isn't a but coordinating conjunction. This is an and. I think the way that American healthcare treats mortality mm-hmm. is that it is to be conquered and to be overcome. Mm-hmm. And most of us think that if we are stricken with some terrible illness, that we turn to our doctors and that they fix it and make it better, and that our ultimate goal is to aim for the longest life expectancy that we can achieve. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is that comes at the expense of our own quality of life. So when I talk about the benefit of death talk, some of that is taking death from out of the shadows of taboo. I think that's important, so that it can be on the table, that we can have conversations about it. I think it's in some ways, helping our medical professionals understand that their success and failure does not hinge on their ability to help a patient survive as long as possible. Mm-hmm. Many authors, Atul Gawande is a name that comes to mind that perhaps some folks have read, but dying well, mm-hmm. this idea of there are good deaths and bad deaths. And I think the bad deaths most often come from a place of trying to extend survival beyond the benefit to quality of life. Mm-hmm. So for me, there are components, advanced care planning and advanced directives that I think folks ought to have in place. But as I mentioned in the post that you reference, I say that the document mm-hmm. is not the goal. The document is one outcome. Mm-hmm. But really the goal is to have an honest and open dialogue with loved ones who will be involved in your care as you approach the end of life, whenever that may be. Mm-hmm. And that those honest, open dialogues, that's the aim of death talk. And then one outcome of that may be some advanced care planning or an advanced directive, something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, for some reason, death seems to still be in the closet. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other things and a lot of other lifestyles and topics have come out, thank God. But death is still there. And so it's ironic, this Friday I'm attending a death cafe. I remember in Indianapolis when the very first one started. Now there's quite a few. So I know that's beginning to happen. But I applaud what you're doing in terms of stimulating that conversation with everybody, healthcare professionals, thank goodness, because a lot of them tend not to want to do that because they think that's a defeat if they give in a little too soon, sometimes with people, the way, you know. But just having this conversation even right now on the radio, I think, because none of us know. And like I've said before, and what I've learned from the people that I've served over the years, look, folks, death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth. You know, it takes all of us. Yeah. We just don't know when.
Yeah. Well, I've tried to say, you know, that the same thoughtfulness and care that we put into the beginning of life, mm-hmm. we ought to have the same thoughtful and care with the end of life.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Bachelor's, master's, philosophy. I've not known too many people who've majored and have been passionate about philosophy. Where did that come from? Did that come from mom or did that come from just where?
My dad is a pastor, uh-huh. And his dad was a pastor, and in fact, he's got brothers who are pastors. So there's a
long line of revs.
That's exactly right. But we also in our family tree, we have folks that are public educators. We have folks that are social workers, folks that are lawyers, judges. Mm-hmm. I think there is a serving of the public interest that lines sort of both sides of the family. So it's in my DNA.
Yeah.
And I think serving in the public interest, whatever that amounts to, I think philosophers like to say, and I'll say this, and I don't want anyone to scoff, but philosophy was there before we had psychology and sometimes before we had law, that there were folks doing traditionally what's considered philosophical work that has now stemmed in different directions.
Yes.
So I think part of serving the public for me was being someone who could help channel some of these big questions and maybe provide an answer and pick other people along that journey with me. So that's a more thoughtful response than I would have given you at 18 when I took my first existentialism class. But it's struck me, and it has stayed with me.
And how ironic that you're becoming a powerful voice over the philosophy of death.
Hmm.
And healthcare, that's the first thing that struck me a couple weeks ago when I first connected with you and learned about your background. I want to ask you another question, though, because you had the good fortune, I believe, of speaking with her. I haven't yet. My best friend is a clinical psychologist at IUPUI, and he told me about her. And it's Dr. Barbara Lipska, who wrote an amazing book, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind, My Tale of Madness and Recovery.
Yes.
What did you glean from her and from that book as well?
I will tell you that my conversation with Barbara Lipska, with Dr. Lipska, was just, it was an hour of sort of just feeling so warm that when I connected with her, and I spent a lot of time with her book. In fact, I reviewed her book for Science Magazine. And, you know, when you prepare a book review, you're doing more than just reading, that you are trying to identify themes. And you don't want to give somebody, you know, I mean, she's spent time crafting this book, so I ought not just skim it and throw a review up there, but you want to treat the book thoughtfully. So I felt as though I knew Barbara in advance of our conversation, and picking up the phone and speaking with her was like reconnecting with an old friend. Mm. So she has that warmth about her. Mm. That book, it does what I think is one of my favorite things about science communication and health communication, I suppose communication studies at large, is that she takes technical expertise and makes it palatable and accessible. Mm-hmm. So I was struck within the first chapter of that book. Dr. Lipska talks about the functional areas of the brain. She talks about the parietal lobe and how the parietal lobe is responsible for knowing where we are in space, where our bodies begin and other objects end and begin. And, of course, my tumor was in my parietal lobe. So I actually, one of my deficits is not being too certain about where I am in space on the left side of my body. There's a blind spot over there. So I think there is a personal message in that book that resonated with me. Further, she had metastatic melanoma that spread to her brain. So there's a brain tumor connection. She was treated with immunotherapy. And it seems to be the case that immuno-oncology will be the way forward in treating glioblastoma. Mm-hmm. So many areas of overlap. Dr. Lipska also immigrated here from Poland. As she pointed out during our conversation, she immigrated when she was 38. Mm-hmm. I'm soon to be 36. So I think these major sort of uprooting life changes coming at this point in our lives is another way that Dr. Lipska and myself are connected.
Yeah. And how are you feeling these days?
So it's, the joke is that if it weren't for the terminal brain cancer, I'm in pretty good health. I feel well. I think that is the truth. I do suffer from, I don't want to underreport. I do have seizures that happen at least once a week. Sometimes they happen daily. They are focal aware seizures, meaning that I remain conscious. And typically that left-sided weakness and numbness, I need to be seated, there's dizziness. That's followed by what's known as a postictal state where I'm very fatigued, typically the onset of a migraine. So these happen regularly. They correlate to the amount of stimulation, stress, anxiety, and activity that I do. Mm-hmm. And I'm busy.
Yeah, so you're very busy. I've been on your Facebook page, exactly.
I'm learning to, the future is uncertain. So there is a grim prognosis around this diagnosis that I've not given in to that. I think that I am a statistic of one. I think that's important. But I also feel motivated to do my very best work today.
Yeah.
So as well as I can manage those seizures and migraines and sensorimotory deficits, I try to manage those so that I can continue to be productive.
Yes, and you are. And it's been such a joy to have you share your story with us today. I appreciate that. You have a great blog. I want to invite all of our listeners to go to that. Can you give the address for that?
Sure. So it is glioblastology.com. So G-L-I-O. B-L-A-S-T-O-L-O-G-Y. So the glioblastoma, the philosophy, ology in there, so glioblastology.
Yeah, and those who are listening, this show is going to be podcast immediately after it plays here at noon. It'll from 1 o'clock on for the whole rest of the week. You can go to richardbrendan.org and also get the link to Adam's website. So, Adam, do you have any final words you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, I think what's been most important for me following the significant change experience, for me, that was a devastating diagnosis and medical intervention. I think for other folks, that can be the death of someone close to them. For folks that have been in a natural disaster, combat troops who come back with PTSD, these are all change experiences. One of the ways that I've handled my change experience is by getting back to the things that feel more like me. So I'm not quite as sharp as I was pre-surgery, but getting back to writing and speaking and reading philosophy, that was the early personal intervention for me that helped return me to some normalcy. Mm. So I think that's what I recommend for folks. Identify your change experience and then relocate yourself on the other side of that.
Philosopher Adam Hayden, thank you so much for those words, and thank you for being a light in our community.
Thank you.
And now, in honor of our 16th year on this station, here's my very first interview I did on this station with John Robbins.
From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, this is The Journey with Richard Brendan.
My guest is John Robbins, the author of The Food Revolution, How Your Diet Can Help Save Your Life and Our World. He's also the author of the international bestseller Diet for a New America. Widely considered to be one of the world's leading experts on the dietary link with the environment and health, John's work has been the subject of cover stories and featured articles in many of the nation's major newspapers and magazines. His life and work has also been featured in an hour-long PBS special titled Diet for a New America. John is considered to be one of the most eloquent and powerful spokespersons in the world for a sane, ethical, and sustainable future. The only son of the founder of the Baskin-Robbins ice cream empire, John Robbins was groomed to follow in his father's footsteps, but chose to walk away from Baskin-Robbins and the immense wealth it represented to, according to John, pursue the deeper American dream, the dream of a society at peace with its conscience because it respects and lives in harmony with all life forms. John, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
I want to talk about your new book because I was very impressed with the type of people who have recommended it, The Food Revolution, How Your Diet Can Help Save Your Life in the World.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to write it. It's a bestseller right now. It's actually, at the moment, in the top five in the country in terms of book selling, in terms of books that deal with food and health.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that it's being received so strongly is that people are sick of being sick. They're tired of feeling powerless. They're sick of seeing McDonald's opening up franchises in schools and in hospitals. And the fast food nation is just a recipe for disaster in so many ways that people are wanting to find tools and resources that enable them to take back their lives, reclaim their health, and establish themselves on a sound footing.
Tom Hartman was one of the people that recommended your book. He said this. He said that John Robbins punctuates the myths and lie balloons that lay millions of Americans in their graves every year. Talk about some of those myths and lie balloons.
Well, the food industry wants to sell you their products, and they don't care whether those products are helpful to you or not. They just care that you buy them, mm-hmm. and that's all they're interested in. And they will, if it serves their purposes and helps to increase their sales, to make you think that their products are healthy, then they'll be happy to do that. But that doesn't mean they are healthy. And if you rely, as many of us do, for our information about our food on the advertising, on the labeling, on the merchandising from the industries, we get a very, very skewered and biased picture that's not at all in alignment with our true best interests and our true self-interest and our true health possibilities.
Talk about the connection, John, between a healthy diet and a healthy environment, because I know one of the premises of this show is the spirit and practice of love for not only ourselves and others, but also for the earth.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you... It turns out, it's a remarkable fact, that when you eat the food that's most healthy for you, personally, I'm just talking about quite selfishly now, what gives you the strongest immune system, what gives you the least susceptibility to degenerative diseases, that gives you the longest lifespan, and we have data on all this. We know what food choices those are. It turns out that those are the same food choices that are the kindest to the environment, that expend the least resources, that mm-hmm. produce the least waste. And that's a fabulous thing. And what those food choices are is a plant-based diet. When you move in a vegetarian direction, when you stop eating so much animal fat, not only does your cholesterol level go down and your heart disease risk go down and your cancer rates go down and your weight drop and you feel trimmer and fitter in every way, but also the environment benefits in many ways. When you eat more organically, not only do you spare your body the exposure to the pesticide residues that could damage you, but you also spare the ecosystems from those same pesticides. The food chains, the environment itself gets cleaned up when we eat more and grow our food more organically. So it's really remarkable to me that what's good for you personally is also better for the world.
So everything really is connected.
It really is. And the big lie in our culture is that it isn't, that you're a separate consumer and that we're in competition with everybody and everything. And what's in your best interest is to defeat somebody else and be better than somebody else. And, you know, it's like it sets us up to compete with each other. And yeah, we're competitive animals, but we're also cooperative animals. And we're also part of this ecosystem and we're part of our communities. And when we learn to act in our true self-interest, mm-hmm. which is different from what the industry that wants us to buy, mm-hmm. die, would have us do, then we find that we're working in partnership with other life forms, we're working in partnership with other members of our community to feed ourselves and feed our communities in a healthful and sustainable way.
Woody Harrelson referred to you as a kind of prophet leading this food revolution. How's the revolution going?
Well, there's two different revolutions happening right now in the world of food and agriculture in this country, and one of them is beautiful and one of them is ugly. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful one is we're seeing more and more people moving towards organic foods, moving towards plant-based diets, taking power over their own choices. As an act of self-respect, as an act of self-care, that's the food revolution I want to support and I'm celebrating and I want to help people to be part of. There's another food revolution going on, though, and that's the movement towards genetically engineered food, toward irradiated food, mm-hmm. Toward more and more technology controlling everything, more refined, adulterated, and processed foods, and more expensive foods. More expensive both at the supermarket checkout stand and at the restaurant when you pay the check, but also, and I think even more importantly than that, more costly in terms of the long-term impact on our health and on the environment. So I'm very much, I'm a cheerleader for the first kind of revolution, the revolution in which each of us takes responsibility for our health. And I've written The Food Revolution, this book that you mentioned, mm-hmm. specifically and completely to help people do that.
Do you find more and more people are waking up to what's going on out there and making lifestyle choices?
Absolutely, they are. More and more people are every day. And, you know, they're realizing you can't just trust the government. You just can't trust the advertisers to tell you the whole truth. And, in fact, you can't even trust them sometimes to not lie.
I know you talked about on a Diet for a New America that on the four food groups that many of us grew up with, that all you have to do is check on the back of that chart to see who sponsored that chart.
Well, the only reason we have a meat group is because we have a meat lobby. The only reason there's a dairy group is there's a dairy lobby. Mm-hmm. There is a need for protein. There is a need for calcium. But those aren't the only ways to obtain it. Mm-hmm. For example, dark green vegetables are actually much better sources of calcium than dairy products. Now, I'm not saying someone shouldn't ever eat dairy products unless that's their choice, but what I am saying is that the dairy industry would like you to believe that you have to eat dairy products, and the more the better. So serve up the ice cream. Mm. When the truth is that ice cream, yes, it has some calcium in it, but it's also full of frozen butterfat and sugar, mm-hmm. and that's not good for you. The butterfat's highly saturated. You're going to push up your rates of diabetes and heart disease very rapidly, and I know about this. Mm-hmm. You know, I am from the Baskin-Robbins family, and I walked away from that empire and the chance to be a billionaire to do the work I'm doing. I'm not saying an ice cream cone is going to kill anybody, and I'm not saying Baskin-Robbins is any worse than any of the other commercial enterprises. But what I am saying is that the more ice cream you eat, the more likely you are to have a heart attack. And that's a statistical reality. That's not a moral judgment. That's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle, Bert Baskin, my dad's partner and brother-in-law and one of the founders of the company, died of a heart attack at the age of 51. 51. My father, Irv Robbins, the other founder and owner of the company, developed very serious diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol and a whole host of problems. This is what happens when you eat that way.
And that's the other side of the story that most of the public is not aware of.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you won't see it in the advertising, but it's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the deep truth, and it's the truth that you're going to have to confront eventually anyway, so why not face it early on so that you can make choices that are truly healthy for you? And this is going against the grain of the fast food culture, but it's a step of tremendous empowerment for people to take.
There's a chapter in your book that I love because it makes me think about the advertisements I see on TV and here on radio, the Great American Diet Roller Coaster.
Yes,
speak about
yes.
that.
Well, so many people are attracted to the Atkins diet or the Sears diet or this or that or the other diet that comes along, which promise quick fixes.
Mm-hmm.
They promise some unusual way of eating that they say will help you lose weight and feel better and be healthier. Well, they promise a lot. They tend not to deliver. That's why I call it the Great Diet Roller Coaster, because they deliver in the short term. You know, there's ways to lose weight that are very healthy, and there's ways to lose weight that are very unhealthy. I mean, just to give you an example of the latter, if someone is undergoing chemotherapy for cancer treatment, they almost always lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
They get nauseous, they're not hungry, they can't eat, they're sick. But that is not obviously a preferred weight loss strategy. Similarly, heroin addicts very typically become emaciated because they're too busy with their habit to prepare food for themselves, and they're lost in that world. They lose weight, but obviously not healthy to do that. There are ways to lose weight that mortgage your health,
mm-hmm.
that trick the body into certain conditions, particularly ketosis, which is what the Atkins diet does, that you'll lose weight in the short term, but in the longer term, you will get a rebound effect. You will get higher rates of heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes, and cancers. And this is all well-known and established scientific reality. And then there are healthy ways to lose weight, and that's what I talk about in The Food Revolution, because it's about developing a wholesome relationship, a natural and healthy relationship to your body,
mm-hmm.
to your lifestyle, and to your food choices, and understanding that there are good foods and there are bad foods. The industry wants to say, oh, no, there's no good foods and bad foods. Just eat everything in moderation. Well, I don't believe in eating poison in moderation. I don't. And I don't believe in killing people in moderation either. I think there are certain things that just are wrong, and there's certain foods that are bad for you. Or certainly they're a lot worse for you than other foods. And so when you learn what are the good foods and the ones that are really full of nutrients and phytochemicals and protein and the good fats that your body needs,
mm-hmm.
But not the bad fats, the hydrogenated fats and the saturated fats that clog you up, then you're empowered to take the actions with your every day, every meal. Mm-hmm. They'll bring you a healthier future and a brighter outlook on life.
You're listening to The Journey with Richard Brendon. My guest is John Robbins. John, there's going to be listeners right now. You obviously had some very strong convictions that caused you to stop on the path that you were on, turn away literally, as you said, from billions of dollars to, I believe, for what, 5 or 6 years living off of $600 a year?
Yes.
Yeah. What can you say to our listeners now in terms of making daily lifestyle choices for a healthier environment and a healthier life?
Well, the choice I made was to walk away from Baskin-Robbins, and my father had groomed me to succeed him, and it was assumed, actually expected, that I would, and follow in his footsteps and with Baskin-Robbins. I'm an only son. It was all on me, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a billion-dollar company. It still is. It was the world's largest ice cream company. It's now third. It's a big company, and that was a lot of pressure on me to do that. But I chose a very different direction because something inside me said that I had no integrity if I did that. And, you know, if you don't have your integrity, what do you have? So I walked away from it and decided I didn't want to live by my father's fortune. I wanted to live on my own values and instincts and powers, if some there might be. And it took a very different path. And we ended up, my wife and I, building a log cabin and growing all of our own food and living off the land for quite a few years. learning how to feed ourselves right from the earth. And it was a wonderful experience because I hadn't really known how to do that before. And I learned a great deal about agriculture and about food and nutrition. And with people, in a nutshell, I would say educate yourself. Mm-hmm. Read The Food Revolution. Read other books that teach you how to eat healthfully, wisely, how to care for yourself and your body, how to live in such a way that your spirit flowers, that your spirit sings, and you wake up in the morning glad to be alive and happy for the experiences that life presents to you, even the challenging ones, even the adversity that comes, because you know that there's something in you that's capable of responding to that.
I was going to ask you, John, how has your new lifestyle affected your relationships, your family? I've always believed that the purpose of life is to love and be loved. You've seen an improvement, and with other people who've joined this revolution?
I agree that I think the purpose of life, for my life, I know, I decided this some time ago, that really the reason I'm here is to love and be loved, and to just bring love into the world, and that's really what it comes down to. And if I can help to make the world a little more healthy or a little more beautiful, a little more joyful place for some people, that's what turns me on. I mean, that's really what makes me feel worthwhile and glad to be alive. And so I do that in every way I can. And in the case of my family, well, when I left, my father was very, very disappointed and angry because his dream was that I would take over the business. It was very painful for me to have to disappoint him. I tried to do it as respectfully as I possibly could. But, you know, you're not here on earth to fulfill someone else's agenda, to live up to your parents' expectations. You have to be true to your own inner voice. And what the irony is that although at the time he was so disappointed, as time has passed, what's happened is his own cardiologist recommended that he read my book. He's read my books. He's made tremendous changes in his own food habits and lifestyles as a result, and he's gotten terrific benefits. He'd be dead 10 years ago if he hadn't changed his lifestyle the way he has, and as is, he's much healthier, and our relationship is closer than ever because there's been this rapprochement, reconciliation, and it's based on truth. Based on me, I'm who I am, he's who he is, and we love each other.
It sounds like it's really based on authenticity. You had
exactly.
to be who you were.
Exactly. And
that takes a lot of courage.
If I put on a mask and just pretended to, do what he wanted me to do, and in the process was committing suicide in terms of who I really was, well, then what good would that have done anybody? But it's a hard choice, and in this case, there was a lot of money involved. And I realized, you know, there are some things more important than money.
It sounds like you've modeled that well. Your own son has a nonprofit organization, is that right?
Yes, he does, Youth for Environmental Sanity. Mm-hmm. They put on summer camps for young environmental leaders and human rights leaders all over the world. last summer, they had young people from 34 countries.
That's great.
Attending their camps, their residential week-long camps, and terrific experiences of bonding and making friends and learning how to work for a positive future.
Speaking of that, John, how do you see the future when you look at especially our country and how we are and where we're going with this food revolution?
Well, I'm hoping enough of us wake up. Someone asked me the other day, you know, was I optimistic? When I look around the world, I would say that it's far too late, and things are far too bad for pessimism.
Well said. You actually wrote in an article, too, I think it was called Our Food, Our Future, that you envision a McDonald's that will be the leading supplier of organic soy burgers.
I think that that can happen, because McDonald's is not just a burger company. They're a food company. For example, McDonald's in Sweden already is the largest supplier of organic beef products in all of Europe.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they're, you know, in this country, Burger King just last week announced that they're going to have a vegan burger, a veggie burger that's totally vegan, doesn't have any animal products at all.
I actually had that.
Did you have it?
I was surprised to see that in there.
Did you like it?
Yes, I did.
Well, I haven't had it. I'm glad that it's there. And it's just a statement, really, from industry. They're putting it there because they think people want to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They've done very sophisticated market analysis, and they realize people want it. And it's healthier. It has no cholesterol in it. It's low in saturated fat, if it has any. And it's, you know, people deserve to have options to eat healthy food. And then their choice is their own. But they need to know which are the truly healthy foods so they don't get sucked into the convenience foods that are titillating in the short term, stimulating, you know, full of sugar and salt and fat, very stimulating, but but which undermine the health of the body, undermine your ability to really enjoy life. Because when you don't have your health, what do you have?
That's right.
John, how much do you enjoy anything if you're not, if you don't have your health?
We have about one more minute. Do you think a hectic lifestyle contributes to that, to the choices that we make? We need something fast right now?
Exactly. I mean, there's something insane about to me about fast food, about eating fast. I mean, can you sleep fast? You know, it's like, can you make love fast? I suppose you can, but is it really the point? Is it as satisfying? Is it as wonderful? Is it as life-giving? And I think that with food, we've gone astray in this culture. We've become industrialized, and we've lost touch with our own deepest instincts for food, a food that really nurtures us, body, heart, and soul. And the food revolution that I'm about is one where we regain that connection.
John, what's the best way people can contact you or get more information on the food revolution?
There's a website, which is www.foodrevolution.org, foodrevolution.org.
Well, John, I want to commend you. You are a prophet in many ways. You've done great work. I know myself and several of my friends were directly affected by your first book, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the show this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Best regards to you.
Okay.
John Robbins, thank you for sharing your journey with us. Henry David Thoreau raised a provocative question. What is the use of a house if you haven't got a tolerable planet to put it on? It's hard to answer. What's the use of science and art and music if our way of life is making the earth uninhabitable? I love music. I've always been a fan of modern dance and theater. I have deep respect for the accomplishments of science. But of all these, take second place in my heart behind the spirit and practice of loving the earth. Because, as Thoreau would say, if you don't have a good planet to put it on, what's the use of having the best home in Indiana? Among all our activities, our first priority should be to change our style of living, from wasteful to simple, from destructive to sustainable. It's not always glamorous work to slowly change your habits and help others to change theirs, to dismantle the old and quietly build a new life. Probably no one will give you an Oscar for having worked to protect the earth, but deep inside, you'll feel the joy of having made a difference, and you'll have won the respect of the hardest person to please, yourself. You just heard a replay of my very first show I did here with John Robbins in 2002. I want to thank my special guest, Adam Hayden, for coming here and sharing a little bit about his journey that he's going through. For more information, you can go to his blog, glioblastology.com. And for a link to that, go to my website, richardbrendan.org. All shows are podcast on that site. And so for engineer Christopher Shoulders and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.